Wow, what a crowd. Awesome. Something must be going on tonight. Something like that. Well, let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tim.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABBA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This is based on the passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Well, we have a surprise for you. Tim M., longtime leader of this group, is going to grace us with his story. It wasn't planned, and we had scheduled another speaker, but I promise you, you won't be disappointed. Tim, please come up.
Thanks, Tim. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Tim Moore.
It's good to be here. I'll tell you real quick how this happened. We had a great speaker, Ed, from out in Roswell, scheduled. Asked him a few months ago, and he's a little bit older, and some of you know him, and I called him yesterday. He's had a lot of health issues, and he was going to come, and I said, how you doing? He started telling me all this, and I said, Ed, I don't know how many people are going to be there. The traffic could be terrible. If you need a pass, we can do it later. He said, I'll come if you need me, but really, it's not a good night for me. I said, great. And we were just going to come here, and Tim asked me to do this. I started working with this meeting about 13 years ago, and this would have been a big crowd. And it's not, I mean, Tim's done a lot with this meeting. I didn't. But we've had, you know, it's been great through the years for me. And I never told my story, though, up till I was 10 years sober. I never told my story here. And Tim was always after me to tell my story. And if memory serves, we had three different people scheduled. One, and he canceled. Another, and he canceled. And another, the night of my birthday. And I said after the third one, okay, I guess I'm supposed to tell my story. So I told it at 10, and that was 5 years ago. So maybe every 5 years. Anyway, it's good to be here. And I don't like to split words because I'm not that smart, but... You know, the prologue says our stories disclose what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. Sometimes people say what it was like, and that's fine if you say that. But you know, for me, the it doesn't change sometimes. But how we respond to it changes. And I hope that I will be able to give you a little glimmer of what this program has done for me and how my life has changed. And I've seen it do it for so many other people. And I am not long-winded. I say that, and I don't want to babble, but I'm really not long-winded. I'd like to share a few minutes. When I finish, it's over. And if somebody needs to share, of course they can. But when it's over, it's over. And we'll all be careful and go do what we're going to do. I was born right here in Atlanta, Georgia Baptist Hospital. My parents were living in Decatur, where I live now. I'll give you a little background about my family. My father's a Baptist preacher. He has two brothers. They were Baptist preachers. And his father was a Baptist preacher. All fundamentalist Baptist preachers. And if you know anything about fundamentalists, and they're great people, great faith, but if you know anything about them, we hear a lot about Southern Baptist in meetings. I'm a recovering Southern Baptist. In my home, the Southern Baptists were the liberals. They really were. They really were. They were the liberals. And I grew up around church people. My entire life was church. My dad's pastored six churches. I had a few in 2 year stints, and then the last church he pastored for 45 years in Suwanee, Georgia. And he retired about 7 years ago, and he still speaks all over. He'll be 85 in a couple of weeks. You know, that's his life, and that's the milieu I grew up in, and it was okay. It was fine. You know, I don't have any sob stories. And to just give you a little idea of what I was taught about alcohol, I was a very meek kid, a mild kid. I was the type of kid you could say, sit in that chair and leave and come back in an hour, and I was still sitting there. I was quiet, wanted to please. And my parents told me a story, I don't remember it, but when I was about 3 or 4, somebody got them a place on the beach in Florida. And we went down and stayed in a little cabin in Florida. And I'm toddling around, and I opened the refrigerator, and somebody had left a beer in that refrigerator. And my mom said, I just started crying and went into hysterics because I'd never seen a beer. And all this preaching I'd heard about beer and what I'd heard about, and I just terrified me. And she said, I thought we might even have to leave. You're so afraid. I was like, what if the people that put it there come back? What are we, you know? And I was just terrified of it. But that gives you an idea of what I thought about, you know, how accepted alcohol was in my family. A lot of people talk about alcoholism runs all through my family. That is not my story. I think I have a grandfather maybe that had a problem in his early 20s, but he found a spiritual solution, and I never talked to him about that before he died. But alcohol was not a part of growing up for me in any way. And when I was 10 months old, they figured I was doing something strange. I don't know. They took me to the hospital, Georgia Baptist, and they found I had a blood clot. I had emergency brain surgery. And got out, they didn't know if I was going to make it. And for a year, I had to wear a little football helmet. My parents have got pictures of it because they were terrified of me bumping my head or something. And if I shaved my head now, if I can remember it, I'll tell you a little funny something about that later. But if I shave my head now, I've got scars everywhere. But the same girl's cut my hair 15 years, and she knows how to hide them. But I've never had any trouble. Never had any trouble since then. I was really great then. And when I was 8 years old, my dad took a church in Suwanee, Georgia. We moved out there, and it was the real country then, Gwinnett County. And that's where I grew up. Went to elementary school out there, went to North Gwinnett High School. And there was absolutely nothing special or exceptional about my growing up. I was happy. It was okay. I wasn't the most popular or the least popular. I was just sort of somewhere right there in the middle. And then I remember my first drink of beer, we stole it at a convenience store when I was about 15 years old. And I had a few swallows, and I still remember thinking, very serious, I got one that's spoiled or something's bad. Because nobody would drink this. Absolutely nobody would drink this. And that was it. And then I think I took a sip or two here and there. And then the first time I got drunk, it was at the Darlington Apartments. It's on the Peachtree across the street from Piedmont Hospital, where the population sign is. I was about 16 or 17. And a friend of mine who was a little older had an apartment there. And I went down one Saturday, stayed with him, had a bottle of Cutty Sark and the scotch, and it happened. And you're sitting here, you know what I mean. I loved it. I really loved it. And no calamity. And I got up the next day and didn't feel great, but I didn't go right out and start drinking more. I was not obsessed, but I liked it. And from that time till the last drink I had, if I didn't get drunk when I drank, I was frustrated. I just assumed not drink is have a drink or two and stop. You know, I just did absolutely nothing for me. And I went to college, did okay in college. I was okay in college, editor of my college newspaper. And then I worked my way through college by buying and selling cars with a guy on Stewart Avenue here in Atlanta. And some of you guys remember Stewart Avenue. And Stewart Avenue is the only street in Atlanta ever that had such a bad reputation. In the 90s, they had a big ceremony out there and just changed the name of it because nobody wanted to put a good business on Stewart Avenue. It was all car lots and strip clubs, and that was it. And so there's not a Stewart Avenue now. It's Metropolitan. It's still dead over there, I think. But I tell people, you know, I got my degree from Georgia State, but I got my education on Stewart Avenue. And I fooled around there, but I had some older guys that really looked out for me. I could have got in. I was really gullible and could have got in a lot of trouble. But I was always seeking another life, maybe rebellious from my upbringing or whatever. And then gradually I started drinking more and more. Got into drugs. For the ones, I don't think it really matters. You know, if you want to meet me after the meeting, I'll talk about it. But it doesn't really matter. But it crept up on me, really. I started drinking. And then I met a girl who knew my family through a church connection, and we started dating, and we got married. And it's funny how your memory plays tricks on you. The first couple of times I told my story, and this is after I came in and started getting sober, I said, at the time I got married, I was 26, played around a lot with stuff, but it had never really gotten a grip on me. I didn't really have that bad a problem when I got married. And then after I told my story a couple of times, I remembered when we went on vacation to Florida, I made sure I had a bottle in my suitcase of 100 Valium and an 8-ball and a flask of Wild Turkey. But I was standing up here telling my story saying I didn't really have a problem. And in my mind, I didn't. In my mind, I really didn't. So the facts didn't change, but my perception of what happened really changed. And then shortly after that, things really started to go south for me. And alcohol got a hold of me. And I believe that alcohol never does anything to you until it's done something for you. And it did do something for me. It brought a lot out of me. And, you know, it got worse and worse. Gradually it got worse. I was in real estate. Most of my adult life I've been in commercial real estate, but there for a while I was in the car business. And that business, in my case, lent itself to being around some pretty unsavory people and situations. And just to give you an example of the psychic change I have when I drink, I remember one night, I was meeting my wife at Lakewood. We were going to see Rod Stewart. And I was going to meet her there. She had already gone down there with some friends or something. And I drive down, and I'm in a blackout at the concert. And I never remember seeing Rod Stewart. I think I got into Lakewood, but I don't ever remember seeing him. And I lost my car, and I lost my car keys. I couldn't remember it. And I found somebody, this is all very hazy, and gave them, I think, $100 to drive me from Lakewood back to Suwanee to my house. Just showed them my driver's license. And they drove me back to my house. I don't know what I gave them. Gave them all I had, probably. And I got to the house, and I remember I didn't have my keys. And she was not home yet, and the house was locked up. And we had, you know, front windows, and we had hanging baskets, three or four hanging baskets in front of our house. And I really wanted a drink, and I took one of those hanging baskets and threw it through the plate glass window. Went through the window, went in the house, and all this I don't remember. But my wife got home a little while after that, and I'm sitting in there with a drink watching television. And when she first pulls up, she thinks we've been robbed or something, and then she sees what's happened. And I'm like, what's the big deal? You know? And I said that to tell you that's that shy kid who the beer terrified, that's what alcohol does to me. You know, the psychic change. I remember one other time I went to the Kentucky Derby, and I guess this is qualifying as if I needed to, but I went to the Kentucky Derby with a friend about that time, and we were in the middle part, the infield, at the Kentucky Derby. And if you've ever been to the Kentucky Derby, you know anything about it, it's like Mardi Gras in there. It's like the cheap seats in a ball game. Everybody's hammered in the infield. And because, you know, it's kids, it's young people, and it's party and all that. They threw me out. They really did. And when I've told this friend of mine who's here in Atlanta still, it's painful to remember, we talk about that sometimes, and they threw me out. People say you can't get thrown out of there, it's like getting thrown out of Mardi Gras. No, they threw me out. That's that quiet kid who would sit in a chair and mind you. You know, that's what happened to me. And about that time, my wife got pregnant, and we had a little boy. Thank God he's okay, and we have a great relationship today, but... And again, I don't like to split hairs with words or something like that, but I remember the first time I ever saw him when he was delivered in that room. At that instant, I would have died for him. And he's 23 now. There's never been 1 minute in his life, if somebody walked in and said, with a gun, it's either you or Preston, well, that's easy. Kill me, that's easy. There's never been 1 second I wouldn't die for him. But I couldn't quit drinking for him. It just wasn't an option. I couldn't. And so that's all about the selfishness, self-centered. I mean, I guess so. But it just had a grip on me. It was not an option for so long. And my wife left me, and she should have. And I did enough. I drug her around a lot. We're rough on people. I know I was rough on people. I wore a lot of people out. And wound up getting in some legal trouble. I went to jail for 4 months. Well, boot camp. I went to boot camp for 4 months here in Georgia, which was nothing. I was about 36 at the time, but they did shave my head. And when they took me in there, they shaved my head. And when they shaved my head, you see all these scars. And I remember the first day a guy comes up to me and says, "Hey, man, how'd you get all those scars?" And I said, "I don't talk about how I got the scars." Okay. And so I think a few guys there thought I was a badass, which could not be farther from the truth. But that was no big deal, just cut grass around the school and all that and got up, you know. And then went to jail a few times, a couple of DUIs, some drug charges, and you know, and my parents did the best they could. They were religious people. They had religious people talk to me. There were lawyers. There were counselors. Of course, the jail time. Rehab three times. Three times. Twice outpatient, once inpatient, and the jail time. And we got to be getting close to the end, right? We are. It's only 7 more years after that. And I think I hit my bottom, what I'll call my bottom, when I was talking to, I always, always had a plan to quit, always. And I was could not have been more serious. I had it all laid out how I was going to quit for about 10 years. And one early morning, where we were is irrelevant, but I'd been up all night, and I'm talking to this guy who's a little older than me, and he's in bad shape too. And we're in a bad place doing bad things. And I'm explaining to him how I'm going to get sober. And he just stopped me and he said, "Pal, wait a minute." He said, "That's not going to happen. Guys like me and you don't get better." I said, no. He said, "No, this is the way it is. I'm older than you. Don't fight it. We're here to the finish. Just relax. You know, don't torment yourself." And I had been to shrinks, counselors, I've been in, as I said, rehab, church groups and everything. But that guy, I've said this many times, flipped a switch in me nobody'd ever found because I knew he was right. It was never going to change. Up till then, people would say, "You're a strong young man. You've got willpower. You can do this." This guy said, "You're not going to do anything. You're screwed. That's it." And I knew he was right. This was the day before Thanksgiving in 2002, the Wednesday morning, about that. And I remember just thinking, "God, please help me." First time I'd ever really, from the bottom of my heart, said that. And something happened. I'll never be able to explain it, but something happened. And now I did drink again after that day. And, but something happened, and then about 6 weeks later, been to a lot of meetings, getting my sheet signed after the nudge from the judge. But I picked up a white chip January 7th, 2003 at the Gwinnett Room. And for some reason, I don't know if it was Tinsley or Julie. Tinsley says it was Julie. But I love the saying, clarity met grace right then. And I just liked coming to meetings, and I started coming. And I was so sick and detoxing. It was God-awful. And I told somebody the other day, you know, we tell people when they come in, we'll give you a white chip, and if you want a drink, put it in your mouth till it melts. I was so toxic, the damn thing probably would have melted, you know, when I came in. But I just started going to meetings, and I was so sick. I was able, because I'd been in real estate, and I had a little income off leases that I could get by on. And I was living in Lawrenceville by myself. I was divorced by then. And I found out about the 6:15 a.m. meeting at 8111. And I would drive from Lawrenceville to 8111 because it just gave me somewhere to go. I'd sleep a couple hours a night, fitfully. And I'd go there and I'd sit in the parking lot or go to the Waffle House and then I'd wait for the 6:15. And at that time, the 6:15 had about 8 or 10 people. And I did that for a couple of weeks. And one day I actually shared. And I said something like, I don't know what I'm doing. My world fell apart. I don't know what to do. But if somebody would talk to me, I'd appreciate it. And after the meeting, a guy came up to me and shook hands, introduced himself, and we started talking. And we talked about an hour that day after the meeting, and he became my sponsor, and he's still my sponsor, Ken H. out of 8111. And I started going to that meeting that I knew about NABA. I started coming down to NABA and started coming a lot to Bridge Builders at 11 o'clock. And I just saturated myself with meetings. And got to know a lot of great people and got with a couple of new guys that had time like me to run all over town. And, you know, it was sort of frantic sobriety is the best way I could say it. Because, you know, we'd go to a meeting two or three times and we'd think, man, this is the best meeting in town. We're never going to miss it. And then we'd come one more time and say, oh, my God, they're all crazy. Don't ever go back there. Well, the truth is, we were crazy. We were crazy. I mean, we were sitting these and. But it was so great. And there's something about people you get sober around. You never forget them. And we started on the steps. And I remember Ken, this is my experience. But we talked and he told him where I was at. And he said, well, I think you've done the first step. And then I would talk. And he said, well, I think you've done the second step. And he said, maybe tomorrow morning we'll go back down to one of the rooms at 8111 and say the prayer. And we did. Started on the fourth step, and I remember when this is that first time we met. And I got up to leave, don't remember hardly anything about those early days, but I remember he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, now you don't ever have to feel like this again. And I walked to my car and I've never felt like that again. I was still broke, I was still sick, you know, I couldn't hardly sleep, but I found hope. I believed this guy when he said, you don't have to feel like this again. And I never have. And things started changing. I did a fourth step and a fifth step. And I remember I was sitting back where Kinsley is, and I had just met Harry B. And Harry asked how I was doing, and I said, well, I'm working on my fourth step. And he said, well, remember, you're looking for patterns. And when he said patterns, it made sense. And then I went to work on it. And when we did my fifth step, I told Ken, he said, what have you learned through this process? I said, you know, I think I've learned that if you took me anywhere in the country and dropped me out of a plane with a parachute and came back in a year, I'd be in the same kind of trouble with the same kind of people. Because my life was like a series of remakes of a bad movie. The plot never changed, only the faces changed. If it was a relationship, if it was a job, whatever it was, it never changed. And, you know, the fourth step was good. It wasn't earth-shaking for me, the fifth step, but it was good. And we through the steps, and then we did our amends, and I remember well, there was one amends that I remember when I first came into AA, said, no, I could never do that one. It was an employer that I'd taken money from many years before, and I really don't think they had any idea I'd taken it. It was about $3,000 in the nature of the business. Nobody knew. But I told Ken, and I said, you know, Ken, I'm broke right now. I've got nothing. I said, why don't you let me get up about $500? And when I've got that, I'll go see the boss and talk to him. And he said, no, I don't think you need to do that. And he said, you're trying to manipulate how he's going to respond, and you don't have any control over how he's going to respond. And I said, well, these steps are something you do all your life, right? I said, let's just do that one on the next pass. He said, no, we can't skip it. I said, all right, then. And I prayed about it. I did what I'd call the easy amends. And I woke up one day, and I just knew it was the day to do it. I wanted to see this guy I'd worked with, walked in his office, and told him what happened. And I said, you know, I've got nothing. I'm broke. I'm trying to get my life back together. You tell me what to do, and I'll do it, whatever it is. And we worked something out and paid him a little interest every month till I could, you know, settle it up. I shook hands with him, and he said, no, we're the best friends we've ever been, and this will never leave this office. Don't worry about it. And I know we don't go by feeling necessarily here, but I remember walking out of his office and I had a feeling I'd never had because I had walked through fear that day. I didn't walk around it. And I was really fortunate. I got back in real estate, and less than a year later, I walked back in that same office and wrote him a check for the full amount. That felt good, but that didn't feel as good as going in there with nothing and just telling him the truth about what happened. And, you know, I just kept going. Things were great. And I was pretty, people were so good to me in AA. AA has always protected me. It's been, I came here, gosh, I'd average 4 days a week at Bridge Builders, then come on the weekends, and, you know, I'd go crazy and talk, and old timers would come up to me and say, God, we're so glad you're here. We're so much better because you're here. And I don't know how they stood me, I've never been that good with newcomers like they were with me. Mark's great with newcomers. He's amazing with newcomers, but you know, they always encouraged me. It was something else. And I remember just a lot of things. I remember I was dating a girl when I came in. I'd been dating her a couple of years, and she was a very heavy drinker at best, probably an alcoholic. That's not my call. And her parents had given us a trip to Puerto Rico, and I was coming up on 9 months sober, and I was scared to death I was going to drink. And I called Puerto Rico, and I got the AA line there, and the guy said, well, I'm not close to you, and I'm not sure what meetings are in that town, but you can at least call me when you get here. And we were leaving at 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. At 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning, I went back to Don Buster's at 8111, 24 hours before we leave. Maybe 10 people in the meeting, and I just shared. You know, I said, I'm coming up on 9 months. My girlfriend drinks like a fish. We're going to Puerto Rico for 6 days. I'm scared to death I'm going to drink, and I don't know where meetings are, so pray for me. And this is the town I'm in and on. As soon as the meeting's over, a guy came up to me that I had never met, introduced himself, and he said, guess where I'm at on business next week? I said, where? He said, the same town you're staying in. And he gave me my 9 month chip in Puerto Rico. Wow. And now, I think Mike and a lot of you guys will second me on this. If you're new and you stay around here, you'll have things like that happen to you. Absolutely. I mean, it's just amazing how AA's always took care of me. And I was pretty insufferable as a newcomer, and I wouldn't change one thing. If I had to get sober again, I'd do it exactly like I did it this time, because, you know, I'm still here. But I can remember I would just, you know, I would run you down to tell you how spiritual I was. You know, I'd tackle you. And I was watching a movie. It's called Rachel Getting Married. A few years, I don't know, I was about 5 years sober. And to make a long story short, in this movie, I think Anne Hathaway is Rachel's sister who's gone away to rehab. And she comes back to her sister's wedding. And she uses the occasion of the rehearsal dinner to make her ninth step amends to everybody in the family and tell about all the guys she slept with in front of their wives and girlfriends. And afterwards, her sister, who's the bride, who's mortified, says, you know, for years, you worried us to death because we saw you were killing us. You were killing yourself. And, you know, we were just scared to death because we love you. And it had to be all about you. I said, but now, it's still got to be all about you. Are you ever going to let it be about anybody else? And I remember hearing that in that movie. And it was like, oh my God, she's talking to me. And I really think sometimes in sobriety, the best thing you can do is let it be about somebody else. Let it be about your parents who you drove crazy for years, or my wife who, you know, my ex-wife. And, if I can just listen, I'm still learning that, but if I can just listen, you know, I have found usually when people come up to you here and ask your advice, they don't really want it. Sometimes they do. They want to listen. That's what they really want. And I think if you talk to an alcoholic from your heart, somehow or other the answer usually comes from within. And, you know, I met my wife in this room. I remember we were really friends for about over 2 years. We'd go to lunch. She was with AT&T then. We'd go to social events. And never even kissed for a couple of years. And then it changed all of a sudden. And we've been married 10 years in May. And it's been great. My son is in law school. You know, he's done really well. His mother is an amazing lady, and we get along great. Her husband's great. We celebrate holidays all together. And, you know, it's you can't get where I'm at from where I started. You just can't do it. And, you know, I'm just such a lucky guy. And Tim has done amazing things with this meeting. I asked Sam Harrison early on, what's the secret to staying sober? And he said, find something and commit to it. No matter what, commit to it. And I've tried to do that with this meeting. And Tim does that. And I would recommend that for anybody. And one more thing, I remember the first 12-step call I ever went on. I was sober about a year, and I was riding out to the river to see this guy, the River Point. And I called Sam, and I said, Sam, what am I supposed to tell this guy? And he says, Tim, I want to tell you just like they told me 25 years ago. If this guy wants to get sober, you won't be able to talk him out of getting sober. And if he doesn't want to, nothing you say is going to make any difference. If he'll listen, you just tell him what happened to you. And I believe that then, and I believe that now. I believe if they want to get sober, you can't say anything wrong. If they don't want to get sober, you can't say anything right. But you say what happened to you. And, you know, thanks, guys, for, it's not too long, thanks for listening to me. And I want to finish with the one thing that when I got my white chip at the Gwinnett Room, there was a lady there named Grace who was sort of the matriarch of the Gwinnett Room. And she gave me my white chip. She passed away a few years later. She sponsored a lot of ladies there. And the one thing I remember about that meeting, I got my white chip, and I was sick, you know, everything wrong. I was trying to get out, and she ran up and stopped me, older lady, real nice, and she said, what's your name? And we talked a couple of minutes. I said, I got to do something. I got to try this. And she said, well, Tim, says, I can tell you how you'll be unique in AA. She said, and I remember, it's funny I remember this, but she said, you go to a lot of meetings, you read the book, you get a sponsor and tell him everything, don't make any changes in your life the first year, and don't get involved with anybody your first year in a relationship. And she said, now if you'll do that, you're going to be unique in AA, because nobody's ever done it. So, now we tell all the newcomers that's what we did, but she said, nobody does everything right. But why don't you get up in the morning and ask God to keep you sober. Get to a meeting, talk to some people, read something in the literature, and before you go to bed tomorrow night, if you stayed sober, thank him for it. Now, I could babble on about a lot of things I've done, but boy, yeah, that's really what I've done. And it's a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been really good to me. You've all been really good to me. So, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for keeping me sober another day. Anybody here feel like taking a drink right now? Anybody want to stay sober? Awesome. Awesome. Okay, Tinsley's going to come up and give out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks so much for telling your story. I liked it. I didn't know what to expect tonight, and I got you, and it was just great. So here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Would anybody like to pick up a white chip? Then after 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anybody got 30 days? We have a red chip for 90 days. Anybody got 90 days? We have a yellow chip for 6 months. Does anybody have 6 months? We have a green chip for 9 months. Does anybody have 9 months? Are there any birthdays that we don't know about? And do we have a presenter for the celebrant?
Well, we kept it secret, but Tim Moore is celebrating 15 years. Well, he's been my sponsor for over 10 years now. And when I first got sober, he told me that I was doing more to keep him sober than he was for me. And, you know, I felt responsible for the guy. And here he is, 15 years. I really look up to this guy. And thank you, Tim. Love you.
Amen. Yeah. Thanks a lot, and you've heard enough.
Anybody else celebrating a birthday? Would anybody like to reconsider on a white chip? big hands for the chips you hold.
Thank you, thank you. Good job. Thanks one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight. If there are no further announcements, I remind each of you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Blame it on the State of the Union today. Blame it on my liquor getting carried away. Blame it on a full moon shining on a love stuck eye. All you can pin on me is that I'm satisfied. Driving you blind. Tell her to a fortune teller in your mind. Tell on a crackhead stealing your fancy ride. All you can tell on me is that I'm satisfied. Same old story getting told every day. Lazy bones who complain the day away. I'm in a good mood. I got nothing to hide. Show up, give me your brain. I ain't even got a mind to complain. Running down the highway.